You're listening to the CryptoCast podcast.
Welcome to the Crypto and Blockchain Talk.
Hello.
Hey.
Guten Tag.
Hallo.
Hola.
Shalom.
Hallo.
Namaste.
Ni hao.
Vivet.
Hello.
Salut.
Yassas.
Salve.
Ciao.
Bonjour.
Our podcast talks about the latest trends in the worlds of cryptocurrencies and the blockchain. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Crypto and Blockchain Talk. I am very honored that today we have again a guest who is filled with knowledge about his very own subject, which is basically the topic we are going to cover about law in blockchain and crypto. And Jonathan Dunsmore is the person who we have in with us today. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you?
Really good. Jonathan is the founder and principal of his own cryptocurrency and blockchain law firm called Dunsmore Law. And Jonathan focuses on all types of law that deal with this space. So we're talking about securities law, everything to do with venture capital, private equity, corporate governance, and general corporate matters within this space. He not only represents private companies, and that is those that are in the blockchain and crypto spaces, but he also deals with angel investors and investment funds. He deals day in, day out with things to do with crowdfunding in this space. So in other words, ICOs or the new three-letter word STOs, and everything to do with what the SEC wants to see happening these days, including these Reg A, Reg D, Reg A plus offerings. Is that true, Jonathan?
That is true. That is my day job.
Well, you know, I want to get into all of these words, and I really want to dissect them during this podcast, because we are saying things, or I should say, I am saying things that not only do I not truly understand the in-depths of, and I think that we have to really look at these words that we're using and see what it means, but I do know for fact that as little as I know about these topics, there are people who know even less. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to start with this, which is, what do you see in your crystal ball? What is the outlook in 2019 for everything in blockchain and crypto? And you can go anywhere you want with this. And I'm thinking of starting maybe with what the legal side of everything will look like. So the floor is over to you, Jonathan. What will it look like?
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. First and foremost, this is all educational. This is not legal or investment advice. Do not use it. No financial advice whatsoever. What I do see from my travels and from my pulse on this entire industry right now is everyone's kind of waiting for crypto winter to end. And what that means is not only is the markets on the crypto side, you know, kind of excited about which projects are actually going to pay off, which ICOs are actually going to keep their word. And we all know that there have been so few that have. But we're also very interested in kind of dissecting the word cross crypto from the rest of the industry, which is now kind of focusing on the word blockchain. It has a little bit less of a negative connotation, and using that to kind of bring in the fold of the institutional investors is kind of almost a necessity at this point. People don't want to hear crypto. They automatically think of money laundering and Bitcoin and all these bad things. And while that is part of crypto and has always been a part of crypto, it's not necessarily the foundation of crypto. ICOs were popular because it allowed the people to make investments and also dump those investments when things didn't work out. But the STO model behind all of this is kind of the newest evolution of this space, and we're starting to see some of the basic projects that are coming together, mostly in the real estate space with opportunity zones in the United States. Those are kind of the low-hanging fruit that everybody's looking at, but a lot of the bigger jurisdictions are looking at, you know, payment solutions and cross-border stuff with whether it's Ripple or kind of other payment processing networks. The transacting of money is going to be very, very important for the entire blockchain industry. And so those are kind of the first major developments in this space that we're going to start seeing more and more of.
Well, it's very interesting what you just said, because I know, because we do a lot of educational pieces. We do them not, we not only have this podcast, we of course have a radio station and a ton of free how-to guides and everything else we give away. First and foremost, when you talk about blockchain, or you talk even about cryptocurrency, they interchange those words. A lot of people don't understand really what the difference is between the two. So just from what you said, and maybe I just want to get some clarification. Are you saying that investors around the world, what they're looking for are just pure blockchain projects, and they kind of want to ignore the crypto side of things? Is that what you're saying? They don't care about the crypto side. They just want to invest in good and proper blockchain projects.
That's a great clarification, and I apologize for not making it more clear. So there's two types of blockchain, quote-unquote, projects, right? There is a project that actually has blockchain integrated into the project, whether it is something with a financial solution, something with a payment mechanism, something with simply a ledger tracking system for any type of data, whether it's supply chain or healthcare data or, mm-hmm. you know, personal records.
Smart contracts and stuff as well.
Yeah, smart contract type of things, private ledger stuff. Or there's just basically an advancement of the current stock exchange stuff and business kind of formation stuff. So when a company issues shares, putting them on a private blockchain that eventually will go and kind of be publicly listed is something that almost any startup can do. And it's going to become as consensus is just kind of thrown down the gauntlet and, you know, admitted to being the bearer of an issuance platform as well, the entire issuance space is going to change dramatically here in the next couple months, because everybody's now realizing that they're kind of selling the same thing. And so, you know, the first category of people that are actually building with blockchain and have blockchain integral to their project is different than someone who is just, pardon the phrases here, but mm-hmm. just the average startup who's using an STO to launch, you know, their capital fund for that venture. And so investors, for the most part, are sticking away from anything that is STO related. And I know that's a shock to some people, unless they understand the space and they see where it's going, because STOs just make sense. Anybody who's been in the capital markets knows how just arduous it is to get anything done when it comes to transfer agents and broker dealers. And God forbid there's an investment bank or there's a big, beautiful IPO that you want to take part of, like Snapchat's IPO a couple months ago last year. Unless you were a very wealthy individual, there was no way in hell you were getting a piece of that pie. And that's kind of the way the capital markets have been since their existence. Unless you had a lot of money and your brokerage firm carved out a lot of shares for you already, you know, you weren't participating in an IPO that was guaranteed to kind of make you money. And so when you have, you know, something like a mechanism for the people, like an STO under Reg A Plus, it really kind of, once we have that full-fledged Reg A Plus, it's going to make capital raising a lot more democratic. It's going to make all of these companies that have problems getting traction with these small groups of angels and VCs who kind of get to determine, you know, what is the next big thing, whether it's e-commerce or these damn electric scooters everywhere. Don't get me wrong. I like electric scooters. I like, you know, being able to go places fast. But all of a sudden, that was the hot topic of investment at the end of Q4. Oh, my gosh, everybody's got to get electric scooters. You know, have you heard of Lime and all these other ones? And investors kind of flow in that pattern, whereas, you know, in the ICO world, you got to see a lot of really, and don't get me wrong, there were a lot of pipe dreams and a lot of dreams that were really aimed too high, but you saw what the crowd can accomplish. And some of that was, you know, purely investment related, because they knew that they were going to get a discount, and then they knew they were going to try to dump it as soon as they could. But once regulation comes in and we have kind of this pathway forward of a semi-publicly reported company, and it'll be publicly reported because we'll be using AI, we'll be using smart contracts, we'll be using all these kind of fun mechanisms to keep everybody honest. And then it'll be much easier for, you know, not only us, but the entire masses to track their investments, to see what's working for them. I've spoke to numerous financial advisors at multi-billion dollar entities. Unfortunately, I can't name them. But they're exceptionally interested in figuring this space out, because for them, it just makes actual dollars and cents to be able to invest their clients' monies at these, you know, exceptionally low valuations, because these companies are so new in the process that when they do actually go to be listed on Open Finance or SharePost or all these other ones that are coming out, that's the opportunity for an exponential return that is traditionally not available for those financial advisors and their clients. And so they're just really excited. I've never heard financial people be so excited, frankly.
Well, I'm even excited. And you know, I think a lot of people in this space are excited for what the STO is going to bring, because the STO, I think, brings us as close as possible, if not almost a layer on top of an IPO as you can get within the crypto industry. Would you agree with that? This is as close as possible to an IPO as you're going to get. Would you say that?
Absolutely. I would call it the everyman's IPO.
And, you know, it is everyman's IPO, just for the reasons that you said before when you were even talking about Spotify. That is exactly the thing that people want. People want to be able to get in on the action. It is everyman's. So you threw out some words before, some definitions I think are needed. There's a lot of people who will be listening to this who are very long in the tooth, and they know exactly what we are talking about. And there's some very new people. So can you please tell everyone, first of all, let's even go one step down. Can you give a simple definition for an IPO, a simple definition for Reg A, A plus, and Reg D?
Okay. So an IPO is an initial public offering. What separates it from a direct public offering, which is another going public process, is that an IPO has an investment bank. And what that means is an investment bank and a company get together, they sit in this big fancy boardroom, and then they say, we have determined your company to be worth X, and the amount of shares that you're going to be selling are worth X. And so we will buy them at a lower price and then try to sell them at basically the market to all the broker-dealers, and the broker-dealer sell it to the financial advisors and you know, on down the chain to everybody gets their piece. And then they have a listing on either the New York Stock Exchange generally or the NASDAQ or, you know, whatever. And that provides them with an IPO pop. So a Reg A plus is a fundraising mechanism that has not really been used properly. You know, there's a couple, Elios, which was the car company, and a couple other ones that have kind of slowly made their way, you know, through the process, but they have not had the opportunity, because even to conduct, you know, after you've done an A plus, it is still an arduous process to get listed. And it's because everything's still so slow. You know, even with the government shutdown right now, which is a whole other issue, it's a very, very time-consuming process. And what an STO does is basically speed everything up. It brings it to the 21st century. And we're able to do that not only just automating a lot of the basic documents, such as subscription agreements and things of that nature, which would need to be signed, but also kind of fundraising. We're looking at different, and we'll get into this, I think, in another podcast, but stable coins that already have a layer of protection in them. So, you know, the money laundering KYC issues that ICOs have are no longer an issue. And so last but not least is everyone's kind of favorite, if you're an accredited investor or an accredited investor offshore, is the Reg D/S combination, because that allows an accredited investor to participate in an offering if they meet certain accreditation standards for their jurisdiction. In the United States, it's you generally have to have over $1 million in assets, with excluding your home, and then you have to make, or you have to make $200,000 for this year and last year to be included, and you have to expect to make that again this year. And so those are pretty high bars, which is why, you know, the ICOs were popular, because most people don't meet those accreditation standards.
So, okay, but there's a third level of regs. There's Reg A+.
There's underlying Reg CF, Reg crowdfunding, regulation crowdfunding, that is up to 1,070,000. And it is the every person's baby IPO, or DPO properly, because there's no investment bank. And so I like Reg CF. There's a lot of really good companies that have used it. One of them was just accepted to IBM's Accelerator program, a company out of my home state, South Carolina, called Bandwagon. You know, they did a Reg CF, I just found out about the other day. And they did all right. But quite frankly, they should have done a lot better because it's a really good company. They've got a really good team. And clearly IBM thinks so. And so there's a lot of people that unfortunately miss that. And I can't figure out why CF is not as successful as it should be. $1,070,000 is not a lot of money. It does take a lot of work to get up to that point, meaning there has to be a good marketing team like Savvy to make sure that, you know, they're putting the right ads in front of the right people and the right content to get to the masses. But I can't figure out why, even all the issuance platforms, I can't remember who they used, but there's an issue there with people not being able to max out that $1,070,000. And if you don't hit that number, I'm not saying it's not worth it. I'm just saying that's a lot of effort not to ring the bell. And so that's why Reg A Plus is so nice, because it gives that ceiling to $50 million, where if you can't develop the startup at $50 million, or anywhere near that, you know, $10 million, $5 million range, I think you're in the wrong line of work. And so those are kind of the three levels.
Tell that to all the ICOs in like the first 2 years when ICOs were hot, when some of these ICOs raised hundreds of millions and then some of them just fittered away somewhere because they realized they couldn't build even with that amount of money what they wanted to, and Lord knows where they are now, or some of them just completely stole it. So, yeah.
And that's a whole nother issue, right? Because, you know, poor treasury management and all of these kind of, you know, we have the business judgment rule in the United States, but that doesn't mean that you still can't be sued, especially if you've made all of these pie in the sky hopes and dreams of space cars and, you know, different type of agricultural stuff. And I just, quantum computing, I can't get over some of the things that did really, really well. But yeah, I mean, if you left everything in Bitcoin and if you, you know, had Lamborghinis on your way to work, it's not going to be good for you. Whether people get their money was worth now or later, in the sense of you know, if you're actually trying to develop out what you've promised, you're going to be better off. But if you're running and you're running scared and you're hiding assets and you're trying to do really shady things, there's going to be a tremendous amount of lawsuits coming. I can't speak to any of the ones that I know of. Yeah, and jail time.
Yeah.
And that's nobody needs that.
Yeah, just like the one that's out of Texas, Rise Bank, the guy who was the founder and owner, Jared Rice Sr., I think he is in major hot water. I'm not sure where he's at right now. I don't know if he's been indicted or if he's been I have no idea where his case is up to, but there's a lot of press time given to people who have either promoted, like Mayweather, yeah. So even if they've just been helping to promote something, which is a bit dodgy, versus somebody who's actually the head of something, absolutely not 100% legit, or they've overpromised, and or they've promised things that they never even intended on doing. Regardless, will all of these regs help stop this?
They won't. There's fraud in the capital markets more so than most people are aware of. And it's, you know, the simple kind of stupid things that, you know, shouldn't happen. And they, I still see them in startup land, where Microsoft or Amazon gives you web services and then you put on your website, you've just signed a deal with Amazon or Microsoft, or partnership agreement, or things of that nature. And those are material misstatements of fact. And so if I'm an investor and I see that and I actively decide to, you know, invest because of you or because of that statement, I can then later sue you when I find out that that was either a lie or a falsity or an omission. If I say, you know, this Arise Bank was talking about how they've been registered with the SEC, or they've registered the name bank, or something ridiculous, where those terms mean something, they have a legal meaning. And so for most of this new space, it's going to help curtail some of the bad actors. They're not going to have the ability to just kind of run wild like they did in the ICO days. But it's also going to be one of those things where there's still going to be lawyers who help perpetrate fraud. Our system is still corrupt, and not to the degree the ICO world is, but you know, you can do an Edgar search or a search of recent SEC enforcement actions, and lawyers get caught up in those all the time, whether it's writing what we call a Rule 144 opinion, which will eventually go away, hopefully, with an ERC 1400 token that basically tells you when the share is freely trading, share, token, whatever. Those kind of things are going to make the capital markets better, faster, and stronger, and more reliable. If I am able to purchase shares of a private company off someone, and then I don't have to worry about getting a Rule 144 opinion because it knows how long that share has been restricted. It knows when it was minted and when it was released and all these other kind of fun things. It just basically pops up in my wallet saying, hey, now you're free to trade me. And that's going to be absolutely wonderful. Those types of movements in the market are going to provide a liquidity and a volume that we've never really had, especially on the private side of things, and especially as private companies try to access capital more and more. You know, speaking of banking, and I don't mean to drone on here, but you know, the first bank that gets it, the first bank that says, wait a second, so we can tokenize, let's say $100 million private company, and they don't want to go public because they don't want to deal with the filing requirements. It costs roughly about $100,000 a year to be a publicly traded company on one of the nationally listed exchanges. For the OTC market's a little bit less, but there's still a significant amount of reporting. And so for $100 million company, they may say, you know, we don't want to do that. We don't want to tell everybody the things that we're working on. We want to be able to freely operate. And there's a number of very large private companies in the U.S., NOC industry or Coke Industries. Those guys have all remained public, or excuse me, private. And so what you could have is a digitization of those assets on the blockchain, so where it's kind of freely audible. You get to see where all the shares are. You get to see who are all the shareholders. And then you can start making really kind of large moves with banks and say, look, we're going to give you all of these shares in a smart contract that says, you know, this is our collateral. We need $10 million to go buy this bank. The crazy thing is once all of this infrastructure is in place, that is simply a matter of an hour or two. You know, it is not the probably 2 to 3 month process of, you know, what collateral are you putting up? What agreements do we have to get the lawyers and the banks to look at and all these other kind of things? Oh, do we have to get the property assessed? Do we have to, you know, do all of these other kind of ridiculously archaic processes that are still existing in the system? You'll be able to see that the title is clear and free, you know, of encumbrances. I mean, there's no lawsuits, there's no lien holders, there's no lawsuits pending. And then you'll simply be able to go in there and purchase the building all on a distributed ledger. And whether it's private or public, for the most part, the purchase of it will be a public ledger saying who it was transferred to, just basically like any system for land deeds in the U.S. But, you know, the private information for how much and things of that nature, depending on the building, that may be assessed as well for taxes. And so everybody will know who's been paying their taxes. Everybody will know, you know, what building may be up for sale because someone's not paying their taxes. You'll be able to possibly be able to get loans and mortgages for real property very quickly. And I know there's competitors like Rocket Mortgage and others that are really kind of looking at this space because it makes sense to give people access to either equity in their home. Eventually, all that will be on the blockchain, or simply with large companies that want to make very large moves very quickly, because it is there's a time value to money, and the more you waste that time, the more you probably, for most business deals, you lose that value. That access is going to be 100% revolutionary for the entire world.
Well, I agree with that. It's going to mean, though, that almost everybody within that current chain of, because we're talking about real estate right now in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, how blockchain is going to be able to revolutionize it, means it has to permeate every single area of it, which means, of course, all the people who are concerned, which are escrow agents, of course, some solicitors or lawyers, mortgage brokers. You know, it's going to have to be something which I think is going to have to, I think it'll completely knock some of these people out of the space, or it's going to have to include them as a key component within the smart contract itself. I already know that this is happening. This is already happening in some places where they're effectively doing real estate transactions on the blockchain. And it is, and if things go the way that they're looking like they're going, it's going to really impact the space in a really great way. This, though, is a huge topic, and I really want to dissect that with you. So we are going to save that for another podcast, because I do think that this is one of the key areas which will be, it will change it forever. It will be just like it will be just like the introduction of the computer into society.
Absolutely.
It will have that same impact from land registry all the way down to it will simplify everything. But it's also going to change the landscape, because a lot of people will be affected, in my opinion. I don't know.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. It's funny. I have an article on my desk that I've titled Adapt or Die.
I think it's option two for many people.
Well, and that's the thing. And it doesn't have to be, because when and I mean that in the most sincere way, because these financial advisors, a lot of the people that have been contacting me, you know, were worried about AI replacing us, all these other kind of things. And I said, you know, for the vast majority of that is an issue. But you can also look at it as a tool, because these people still want to talk to people. When I'm sitting down with a client, whether it's via Skype or in person, and we go through kind of the entire process of what they're trying to accomplish, it is much better understood with an actual individual who can comprehend and adapt. We don't have AI that is capable of having an articulate conversation, the proper process and how to make sure every mechanism is covered and taken care of. And so it just becomes more of a customer-centric focused venture than it does if it was just a basic service industry kind of, well, you know, you need an IRA and these are your options. I mean, for most of us, especially that have grown up in this, you know, kind of financial revolution, we remember having Scott trade at like $7.95, you know, 20 years ago, going, oh my gosh, that's crazy. I can have a self-directed IRA and I get to pick everything and I only have to pay $8 a share or $8 a trade. And then once you start doing it in the math, you realize that you're paying, you know, $16 to open and close and all these other kind of things. And so that moved all the way to the Robinhood model of where it is free to trade. And so in 20 years, we've gone from, hey, we've broken it down to what at that time was an insane price of $16 to open and close, to now Robinhood's being like, you can trade all you want. And that is where, and don't get me wrong, Robinhood has certain fees kind of buried within it sometimes, but
yeah.
You know, there's still a lot of advancement that's been made in that entire process. And so that's the example that I give most financial advisors, but I'm saying, you know, this time it's on your side. But the good news is, if everything works out, like I said, you'll be able to get access to those really early stage companies. And a lot of people have to, you know, this is where we go back to the formation and the corporate documents and agreements and stuff. You know, those agreements and those investment advisory agreements are going to have to change to allow for what we call venture funding to be added to the list of things that it's okay for financial advisors to try. And people are going to have to set their own risk aversion and say, you know, oh, I'm, you know, 20 years old. This is my first full-time job. You know, max me out at 90% risk and 10% kind of secure bonds and things that are stable blue chips. And then just dump everything else and all of the kind of emerging technologies. Those types of opportunities are going to be available for everyone of every kind of age range and bracket space. So I look at it as, if you are hard-headed and stubborn and don't want to move out of your space because you think that this is the best and end-all be-all and the old way is the best way, history has proven you wrong, my friend. And so it is better to adapt and figure out how to evolve your practice or your area of business to use this instrument to make it better. And as you said with computers, I remember when business owners, even my father, you know, oh, I don't need a computer. I don't need a website. I don't need any of this stuff. I don't understand this stuff. And what you saw was, you saw the people that started to use that as a tool And then they evolved and they aggressed and they grabbed more market share. And that's kind of when everybody were like, well, they're doing really well with it. I might as well give it a try. I'm sure that you can remember that back in the days when you didn't have an email address. And so, you know, people used to have to write you letters and remember your phone number. And now we're just like, oh, well, I have his email address. I can always reach him. Yeah. And him or her. And that's just unusual. You know what I mean? To be able to always be in contact.
Absolutely. And actually, that's another topic even, because there's way too many ways to reach people these days. Because just like with you, Jonathan, if I can't get you on Skype, I'll try you on WhatsApp, your telephone, I'll keep ringing till I get you. You can't shut that off. Yeah. So, okay. So, well, what I want to do now is I want to look at what happened last year in 2018. I'm going to go back to something that you just mentioned, and I want to put a frame. First, I want to put a frame around something that you just mentioned, which was basically about looking at companies who claim something and how to check this. And I'm really talking about the SEC's EDGAR's site, but let me first frame what I'm going to say, and then we can take it from there. In October of 2018, the SEC announced that it was obtaining the emergency court order, which was going to halt BlockVest. And their initial coin offering, because they falsely claimed that it was registered and approved by the SEC, and along with a bunch of other things which were not true. I think licensing by FINRA, and it was audited by Deloitte, and none of this was true. But as you know, because I called you the other day, I actually had an investor who called me up and who said, I heard that this company was going through this new format called the STO, and that they had filed papers for the different regs. And I called you up and I said, I just wanted to know what was the quick and simple way of checking this. And this is when you said the following. So repeat what you told me on that day for the audience.
So anytime someone files, quote unquote, with the SEC, that generally means they've filed Form D. Form D is a notice filing saying, hey, we're going to raise money using Regulation D, generally, is when they use it. But they also use it for CF and A+ and all these other kind of things. It basically just kind of tells you that, hey, this is what we're doing, SEC. And so that's kind of, you know, the first step in the process. And don't get me wrong, there's a 15-day period, so roughly 2 weeks between, you know, when they have to file and when they accept their first investor, so they can have a first investor and then, you know, file. But that is kind of the crucial mechanism to see if someone, especially someone based in the U.S., is really playing by the rules. Now, it does get a little murky because Reg S doesn't necessarily need that filing, but it doesn't make sense to basically do a Reg S, which is an offshore for accredited investors, and not do a Reg D, which is onshore in the United States for accredited investors. And so that is kind of the first part of due diligence that I look at to see how well that has been filled out, and basically kind of gives me a little bit of peace of mind that, oh my gosh, this person is actually comporting with the law. Because as we know, in ICO world, that was not an issue.
Nope. And so, and made up, as we just showed with BlockVest.
And yeah. Made up. And I believe they filed Form D, but it was a mess, or they, you know, had multiple exemptions or something. So
I'd be surprised if that was the case. I don't think they did anything.
Well, I mean, these are the same people that used the SEC's logo and claimed that they had permission. And so, I mean, it's one of those things where you've got to be able to verify. You know, we're in the world of fake news, regardless of your political opinions and things of that nature. It is very important to do your own due diligence and smell test. If it doesn't,
absolutely.
If it doesn't make
absolutely.
Sense, you've got to look into it more. If it sounds too good to be
wait.
True, look in more.
Wait, this. I'll remind you who this company are. This is the company that came up with a fictitious blockchain regulatory agency, which was supposed to be managed by the SEC, and they called it the Blockchain Exchange Commission.
Yeah.
And then they took the SEC seal, they changed out the word securities, and they put blockchain in instead. So they actually replicated the government's official seal for the SEC so that they could claim that they were with the, you know, they were part of the BEC. So going back to how do you check? The answer is this site that you told me about. Come on, Jonathan, bring it home for me.
Yeah. So you have to go to Edgar. Just type in SEC and Edgar. Do a company search. You should see the Form D filed. If form, it'll say D/S if they, or excuse me, D/A if they've amended it. It's the basic kind of filing to make sure someone's reporting with the law. It's the best way. It's the best first step. Because there is no other mechanism right now. And I wish there was. I wish there was another kind of idea of how to push things forward to make sure that someone is on the straight path. But right now, Form D is best we have.
Okay. So talked about a lot of letters of the alphabet we've had so far. And I want you to, because I want to make this crystal clear for the audience. So, and I'll go in alphabetical order, by the way. I'll start with Reg A+, Reg A, Reg D, Reg CF. We have Reg S. And I think maybe what we should also do, besides obviously doing maybe again a one sentence roundup for each one of these, I'm thinking maybe we should also, and again, everyone remember, this is for educational purposes only. We are not giving you any advice on how to do anything. You have to do your own research, your own due diligence. But I think what we should do is attach to the description within the podcast a little definition block of each one of these regulations. But can you go over one more time what Reg A+, Reg A, Reg D, all these regs. Do you want me to just say each one as we go and then you give the description?
No, I think I can remember them.
I know you can. I was testing myself.
Well, in that case, have at it.
Okay, so Reg A+. Let's start with that one.
Reg A+ is a public offering. And so when you look it up on Edgar, what you'll see is either a 1A or an S1. And that means that they've kind of filed their registration statement with the SEC. For the blockchain, that doesn't really exist right now because the SEC doesn't understand how it would work on the back end mechanisms. But we believe that is coming. Okay. What's the next one?
Reg A, no pluses.
Reg A is kind of the same thing as Reg A+. It just
did better at school.
Actually, it just did worse. Because the Reg A, it's not functional. It doesn't work. It doesn't work in the blockchain space. It's the same thing, for all intents and purposes. But the A plus was the one that was created on the Jobs Act that allows for unaccredited investors to invest up to $50 million and make reporting a little bit easier and all these other kind of things. So Reg A plus is the one we focus on.
Okay, then we have Reg CF.
So Reg CF is a crowdfunding mechanism for unaccredited investors for a company or issuer. Company/issuer means the same thing. For $1 million 70. So $1 million 70. That's kind of for the brokerage fees, if anybody's wondering why that weird number.
It is very weird.
And so what you would look for, generally speaking, is either on the website that the offer is being conducted on. Most of them are very reputable. You'll see a Form C, and that means they've filed with the SEC, which, like I said, does not mean that it's a good offer, does not mean it's good investment advice or that they're actually going to go through with their claims and promises. It just simply means that they're trying at least even facially to comport with the law. So that is Form C that should be looking for. For a Reg CF offering, and that includes accredited and unaccredited investors, but mostly unaccredited.
Okay. Well, then we come to Reg D, which is the onshore for accredited investors, correct?
Correct. So the one that kind of see all about allows for general solicitation, which is Rule 506C of Reg D. And so that's where you go to Edgar and you see, you know, the Form D filed. Like I said, there may be a 2-week delay if you don't see it. They may have just started. Generally, most, you know, file beforehand. But once you file, you kind of have, you know, the clock running against you. And so that is the most common because we don't have Reg A+, and CF is a, like I said, for some reason, it's not a widely used mechanism because it doesn't have a lot of success. the Reg D is quintessentially the STO right now. It is the de facto STO.
Last and definitely not least is the Reg S.
The Reg S is simply the Reg D without the United States. And so this is a really weird mechanism where it's an exemption from registration. And so this is tough because they don't have to file anything with the SEC because basically everything is taking offshore under rule, I think it's 902. Even, and here's really tricky to quiz the people participating at home, is you can technically be an American investor and leave shore and conduct a transaction, and it could fall under Reg S. So I'm waiting for some, this is not investment advice, this is not financial advice, this is not business advice. I'm waiting for, you know, these cruises to start like picking up on this, oh, come to Bermuda and conduct Reg S offerings. It's only a matter of time, but especially as this space starts to develop and the longer we do not have Reg A Plus on the blockchain side of things. We still have it on the capital market side of things, of course. But the problem with a Reg S is that you cannot see with the SEC what they filed. The exception is if they've done a DS, which makes sense because it's basically the same agreement, but they need to be two different sites. They need to be two different kind of letterheads, two different what we call boilerplate kind of disclosures on the front saying who it's for. Those kind of things should lead you to the conclusion that at least they're trying to comport with the law from the regulatory filing part. But the S is tough because, like I said, there's no form S. There's no letter saying, hey, we're going after an exemption. You don't have to do that. If you think that's the case, be very careful because there should at least be generally a form D. If it's offshore completely, if it's a Hong Kong, Singapore, Estonia, Malta company, and they want to take advantage of Reg S but not Reg D, which is a little weird, but I've seen it, then you've got to kind of look and sue, are you seeing other legal language? Are you seeing that they're requesting accreditation standards? What level of KYC are they doing? Do they have a lawyer listed or a law firm? That's kind of a good standard. And we have different rules and requirements for publication of that stuff. But in my retainer agreements now, for my clients, it says that I'm allowed to list you publicly, and I need to go update some lists, especially on LinkedIn, because that's what everybody uses. But it's almost a way to verify that that lawyer is working with that company. And that's one of the reasons you'll see my picture on a lot of sites, is because that kind of gives them, that verification.
You know, we're talking about what's happening in 2019. So let me just ask you a few things. First of all, doing this work, to do all of these filings in order to make sure that, because no one's going to do an ICO anymore. They're not. They're going to do an STO. They are. Otherwise, it's just going to be a mountain of pain. Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. So, there is still...
Oh, I hate when people say yes and no.
I'm a lawyer. Of course I'm going to say yes and no. I mean, the lawyer answer is it depends. You can, in theory, still conduct an ICO that is a utility token that is on a functioning beta.
Wait. Before you go any further, I mean, I've already heard enough. Except for the usual suspects, and I'm talking about Bitcoin and Ethereum, these are what they would classify as, not Bitcoin, what am I on about? So Ethereum. I mean, there's very few coins, and I would say hardly any tokens, that would be classified as a utility token without the SEC disagreeing completely and then coming after you and putting you in jail, shutting you down, fining you. I don't really know of so far any company that the SEC has said, "Yep, you're 100%." Except for Ethereum, I think is the one that they did say. I don't know of any that the SEC has said, "Yep, you're definitely a utility. We're hands off now. You guys are fine. Get on your way."
Yeah, so the SEC has made comments. Even Clayton, the chairman of the SEC, has made comments. All those comments don't really matter. and what I mean What I mean by that is, that's a good pulse on where everything is, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not utility tokens out there. There's a lot of securities attorneys we've kind of all, and I can't claim this test. You know, we talked about it last time on the podcast. I believe if it's a utility token, meaning it stays within system, it has a functioning beta, means that it's actually something that works, whether it, you know, the token is in the background or actively kind of bouncing around like a Mario coin, and it's not traded on a secondary platform, that is a utility token. Once you take it off that platform and you put it on an exchange, it almost positively falls within the jurisdiction of the CFTC. And I really hate saying that aloud, because I think the CFTC and the SEC are going to be battling for once the government starts opening up in Q3, Q4. I think they're going to start butting heads, and you're going to see a lot of lawsuits and the government suing the government. And
even more.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Lawyers are going to be very busy this year in this space. And so it's going to be, you know, that kind of standard, I think, is going to be set, where it's basically a subscription model, right? I can sell you a subscription to access my site at a beta level. I can't promise you that the price is going to go up or, you know, anything like that. But I can say that, you know, look, you know, we're charging for 100 people or 1,000 people or whatever people, it's $10 to get in. But, you know, when we release alpha, it's going to be $100 to get in. And so that is still a quote unquote fundraising mechanism. But because you're actually selling a product, that beta access, then it jumps over the fundraising capital mechanism. And that's incredibly complicated. And don't get me wrong, if you are listening to this podcast and going, oh my God, that's me, you still need a legal opinion. You still need to have a lawyer in your jurisdiction tell you that that's you.
Well, that actually leads me very nicely onto my next question. Okay, so there's obviously going to be some ICOs listening to this, or some people thinking of, sorry, I shouldn't say ICOs. There are companies out there who are thinking of raising funds using this space and world of crypto. And whether or not they have a legitimate use of blockchain, we're not even going to touch that. But these people who will be listening to the podcast, can they fill out this paperwork on their own and submit it to the SEC, all these regs, or do they need to have a lawyer? Absolutely.
Well, so the answer is, once again, it depends.
God, you're killing me.
Well, the Form D is not a tough document. The Form CF is not a tough document. Do I recommend someone draft an S-1 registration statement? Absolutely not. And I know some very brilliant people that have, and some of them have been successful with it. It is very tough to do that. But that being said, Form D is not that tough. Form CF is not that tough. But the problem with all of these is if you make a mistake, me or any other lawyer is going to charge you a lot of money to fix that mistake, because it is so crucial that it's done right the first time.
Of course.
And so for an ICO, the problem with an ICO, going back to filings and due diligence, is if they're doing a true ICO and it's a subscription model like we've discussed, there is no Form D. There is no, you know, CF. There's no forms filed generally with the SEC if it's under this kind of subscription ICO model, because it doesn't need to, because it doesn't fall within the jurisdiction of a security. And so that is kind of a whole nother mess of things, which is why if it is an ICO and it is claiming that it is a utility, then, and this is a new gold standard I want to set right here and now, there needs to be a legal opinion put up on that website. And whether you see white paper or full white paper, technical white paper, and legal opinion, that needs to occur. And I know a lot of lawyers are against that because, oh, that's my work product and people can just copy and paste and things of that nature. But we need to kind of start setting a new standard of, this is what this means, this is how we interpret this. Those kind of mechanisms are going to make this space a little bit better for everyone else. And I know there's very few ICOs still kind of, or companies thinking about doing ICOs, but to have that legal opinion, whether it's through a clickable link or something where, you know, you've got to request a legal opinion, something needs to happen. There needs to be a step forward in the structural mechanism to make sure that these people are comporting with the law. And right now we don't really have that, because there's no one they really need to comport with if they fall outside the jurisdiction of the CFTC and the SEC.
So taking a step back and pretending now that you are Well, you could still, I guess, be a lawyer or solicitor, depending on what country. But taking a step back, if you had to choose into what kind of company you would invest your hard-earned money, would you still invest in a company that was not looking like it was registering itself in this method and fashion? Would you still go for the old school ICOs that just literally just posted and said, hey, you know, throw your money at us? No, there's no regs which we've applied for. The SEC, we never heard of them. Would you still invest in those, or would you be more inclined to invest in a company where you can find them on Edgar and you go, well, I know they're serious. I know that it's going to end up being a more legitimate investment for myself, a little less risk, even though obviously all investments are risks. How would you actually go forward with this as an investor?
That is an absolutely wonderful question. And this is not investment advice.
Absolutely. We are not giving investment advice. You have to do your own homework, your own due diligence, folks.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
And so what I generally look at is I look at the team and I look at the paper. And I look to see if they understand what they're talking about, because I have a fairly elementary understanding of the technical work. But does it make sense? Does it make financial sense? Are people, are they claiming they're going to get, you know, 10% of a $1 billion market cap? That kind of stuff is outside the realm of possibility, especially for a startup. And so if they're making these kind of pie in the skies claims that they, I saw one the other day, and I'm not going to name any names, but they were claiming that they were going to have almost $1 trillion in assets by 2040. I mean,
that could be one of a million projects, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, that's a substantial claim. Mm-hmm. And so they've got to be able to back that up. And if the financials work, then hey, the financials work. But if you don't understand financials really well, then you need to have someone to be like, hey, you know, you've got a degree in economics. Can you take a look at this? Does this make sense for me? You have to be a prudent investor. You have to take the necessary steps to make sure that what you're looking at makes sense. If it doesn't make sense to you, find someone who it does make sense for. And that person may charge you, they may not. They may be a friend, they may be a family member, they may be, you know, some person on Reddit whose identity you can verify. And, you know, that goes back to the other issue of identity. And there's a number of people working on solutions with this, but the best we have right now, unfortunately, is LinkedIn. And if you can't find these people's social media profiles and you can't find them on Twitter, or, you know, you go to their Twitter account and it's all bots and things of that nature, you need to start being worried. They have websites that you can do Twitter audits, and some of them are more reliable than others. So, you know, do a couple of them. You don't have to pay for any of them. I think most of them are free. Does it make sense that someone graduated from Harvard and Yale? You know, maybe.
At the same time.
Yeah, at the same time. You know, all
wow.
You know, I say this in this article that eventually going to come out when it gets off my desk. But we need to be able to verify people's credentials. And to the credit of Block Certs, you know, I'm here in Bahrain, and they've added their program to them. And so now their diplomas will start being verified going forward. And that's huge. That's absolutely crucial.
That is huge. Absolutely.
But that's the kind of mechanisms we need. People need to know that this person actually worked for Microsoft. I see a lot of Microsoft people out here, and,
yep.
You know, I am not sure if all these people work for Microsoft, because they don't claim to know anybody, or they don't have the same, you know, and don't get me wrong, Microsoft's a huge company, but
you misheard. They were working for Microsift.
Yeah, Microsift, exactly. They misspelled it, and then they, you know, LinkedIn put the other person. Yeah.
Or Microsift.
And so you've got to be able to verify these things. If you can't verify, if it doesn't sound right or it doesn't smell right, you know, trust your gut. You got to go with your gut. And that's going to save you more money.
But you really don't care if they're like going through the STO process? That really doesn't mean a hill of beans to you?
I applaud the people that are actively working to go do STOs or even ICOs comporting with the law under the utility protocol we just kind of described, because those people are the pioneers. Those are people that are setting up their email addresses in 1994. Do you know what I mean? Those are the people that are at the middle of the dot-com boom going, look, we are actually a business. We are staying strong. We are Amazon. We are functioning. We may be taking losses, but we are going to keep riding this out because we believe in what we're doing and we're damn serious. And so I don't fault the entrepreneurs that are the pioneers of this space. I applaud them because it is a tough space. You're talking about a global marketplace. You of all people know how tough it is out there. And so
sure
these people are heroes, men, women, everyone. They are all fighting for, you know, their piece of the pie. And the people that actually believe in this space, I applaud them. If I see an STO, if I see a project worthwhile, I will like it. I will share it. I will try to, I have no affiliation whatsoever with Bandwagon out of, like I said, South Carolina. And I love the idea of being able to not be price gouged and have the venue understand the people that are coming into the venue so they can make better choices, so they can get the data analytics to make smarter decisions, whether it comes to, you know, healthy food options. You know, not everybody wants a delicious, greasy hot dog. Some people are, you know, want a vegan or a keto alternative or things like that. And those kind of next level data points are something that's going to be really valuable moving forward, especially as this world progresses and evolves to become more of a global marketplace.
So in terms of everything that is happening in the United States, you're going to be going then to Tokyo to be speaking at a major blockchain conference. Are other countries looking at the United States and looking to mirror what's happening there? Or if somebody is right now running in some kind of ICO in another country, and they are looking to get American investors, and they are going to be needing, obviously, to follow the rules of the SEC. And if they don't, then are they coming to you and asking what they should be doing in all these countries that you're going to? Because I know you're giving a lot of advice to a lot of companies in a lot of countries. So what are they doing? Are they trying to mirror what the US is doing? And how are they still allowed to talk to these people in America if they're not following, you know, what I guess the legal protocol now is?
Yeah. And so that's your favorite.
I know we covered this also before, some of this in the last podcast, but I just want to bring it home.
So it depends. You know, the people that are really trying to comport with the law are going to do everything they can to not piss off the SEC or eventually the CFTC once it starts getting really aggressive, and it's starting to get that way. But from what I've seen, at least in especially my most recent travels here in Bahrain and I assume in Tokyo, where regulation is very important to the Japanese, and they are very strict and like comporting with the law. And so people are just kind of curious how to access that market. You know, all of my speeches and talks are educational of kind of what the status of it is, how to, you know, get involved, how to make sure that you're not messing up and not getting in trouble. Those are the things that people want to hear, especially if you're a company or an issuer. And as an investor, for the most part, most investors know how to access, especially if you're an accredited investor, you know how to access the US markets. But non-accredited people are slowly learning about CF. They're kind of keep waiting for, and some of them keep pinging me about, hey, has there been an A-plus approved yet? Because these people say they've got an A-plus, and I'm, you know, mm-hmm. Those kind of educational talks still need to go on, and those are kind of the things that I talk about. But for the most part, everybody's really kind of over the Wild West style of not knowing if these people are real or not knowing if you're going to lose your money. And, you know, I still get, and God help these poor people who have invested in ICOs and they've just run off. I had a potential client call the other day that invested too much money in an ICO and nobody is getting back to them. The Telegram's blowing up and it's just one of those things where everything is burning to the ground and it looked like a completely pump and dump scheme. And so, you know, that's going to cause lawsuits and people are going to run to different jurisdictions and all these other kind of crazy things. And don't get me wrong, there's statute of limitations for most of this, but not for most of the criminal stuff, especially if it's one of those things where you run. We get to kind of hit the pause button on the criminal action and say, oh, well, we'll catch you when you come back to the U.S. You know, the ironic part about all this is the use of blockchain is probably going to be used to track down some of these people. And then
the irony.
The irony is sharp, because it's also probably going to be used to seize assets. I know there's a lot of exchanges that are looking at trying to, I think I mentioned this last time, red list wallets and things of that nature. It's eventually going to get to the point where we're going to see where a lot of this money is going. The criminal element of crypto is a little worried about all of that, as they should be. But a lot of the ICOs that have, for whatever reason, ran off, you should come back and you should try to do right. Your consequences are going to be significantly less dire if you play by the rules now than if you run away.
You know, I have a feeling many people who are also listening to this are going to be thinking to themselves, I want to do the right thing, and I am scared of what I should be doing. I don't know if I'm doing the right or the wrong thing, or if I should be attempting this by myself in terms of, you know, actually putting together their whole crowdfunding program, and they're not maybe sure of what to do. And they are looking for resources to help them put together their ICO. So from a legal standpoint, do you have some kind of checklist or something where ICOs can come to you and say, okay, I've done this, I've thought about it. Do you have that kind of a checklist?
I have a three-part method, and I capitalize this on I apologize, Craig, if you ever listen to this, I can't think of the name of the the article that was just published, or the magazine that was, I think it's Converge. But there's a three-part method. Is if you think this is a fundraising mechanism for you, I need you to Google the absolute living hell out of it. What is an ICO? What is an STO? How does all of this stuff work? And then when you get to the point where either you get scared or you've decided to change the decision to do, you know, a normal kind of capital raising mechanism or subscription model or whatever, that's fine. But if you want to continue to push forward and be one of those pioneer entrepreneurs that we talked about, that's when you give someone like me or my colleagues a call in your local applicable jurisdiction, because it is going to get over your head fast. And there's no problem with that. As I said, you know, for complicated financial models, I don't do those myself. I'm a lawyer. Lawyers hate numbers besides tax attorneys. And so I have a finance guy who, lucky for me, he just generally requires a case of beer or two or a good bottle of scotch every once in a while. And so
I think everybody wants to know your friend.
Well, I don't want to support his alcoholism more than me. I already do. Just kidding.
I figured as much.
Yeah. he's a good guy. but, you know, that's the step process, because the long and the short of it is everyone from your cat to your business partners to your co-founders to damn sure your investors are going to question why you've taken this path. Why have you taken this harder road right now? And if you cannot answer that, if you cannot give an articulate statement of why you've decided to go the long way around because you think your company will be better off in the long run, then you should not do an STO or an ICO or any type of digital offering at this point. You need to stick with the old rules and the old ways and try to manage them on that, because that's going to be some fierce opposition. And so it's a three-step process. Google the hell out of it. Understand as much as you can. You know, find someone who is we don't like to say subject matter expert, but someone who practices in this area, someone who is a lawyer or a solicitor that understands this kind of stuff.
Proper lawyers. Yeah,
exactly.
Proper lawyer or solicitor.
And then three is make the decision. Three is, you know, find out if this path is still right for you after having a consultation with someone who is, kind of aware of the law.
Okay. So that's step three. So in closing, do you think that investors in 2019 should be still investing in the crypto and blockchain space, or should they be more wary than normal? Should they be more wary than other investment vehicles, more wary than they were last year of crypto and blockchain projects? What do you think 2019 holds for investors in this space?
I think somewhere in this investment cohort is the next Warren Buffett. And I don't take that lightly. I think there's going to be, and I've seen a number of firms that are very, very aggressive. They're very selective. They're very strict in their requirements, but they also understand that most of these guys and gals are startups. And so they do a lot of handholding. They do a lot of kind of basic management stuff, consultancy that is just kind of not necessarily below the company, but above the company. They're not at that point where they're able to functionally run a 50-person team yet. They don't know how. And so as an investor or as a potential investor or as people who are investing right now and moving forward, I think that it is an excellent time to notice some really, really strong teams. Because like I said, these are pioneer entrepreneurs. These are a different brand and a different breed. These folks are really determined. They believe in this technology. They've seen the writing on the wall. And to get at this level is basically the equivalent of buying Bitcoin back in the good old days of 2010, 2011, 2012.
16 cents.
Yeah. And so when you're able to hitch a ride, whether it's using CF, whether it's using D/S or eventually A+, I think you're going to see your investments just absolutely do ridiculous things. And you're going to have those articles in Forbes where it's not going to be Bitcoin bros and things of that nature, but it's going to be, you know, really smart people who are going, you know, I really liked what the company was doing, and then I gave my financial advisor or numbers person a case of beer or a bottle of wine or something, and they said, yeah, these numbers kind of work. Even if they can only grab 0.10% of market share with this technology, they should be able to reach $10 billion by 2030. And so those numbers really work out if you plan them right. And those are the opportunities that this industry is going to provide. Because those same investors, especially the unaccredited folks right now, they don't really have those chances. They don't really have that opportunity to take $10,000 or $15,000 and turn it into $150,000. That's just unheard of wealth, and that's unheard of gains. And don't get me wrong, there's going to be a lot of money lost. But I think if people are practical in their due diligence, their understanding of what's being made, and then reach out to people that know the areas of that project that they do not know, it just makes financial sense to try to move forward with these companies that are still brandishing their shield, you know, fighting this fight of blockchain, because this is a different breed. This is not the easy world of ICOs. This is not the put up a white paper in a fancy web page and get $10 million. That doesn't exist
anymore.
Yeah.
No. And you know what? I like that idea, the fight for blockchain and crypto. And I like the idea that you and I are on the right side of the fight.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is nice to be on the right side of history.
I couldn't agree with you more. Jonathan Dunsmore, I would like to thank you so much for joining us for this week's Crypto and Blockchain Talk podcast. It's certainly not going to be the last. This is one of many. And I would just like to say to you, I know your time is really valuable, and I think you've given a lot of valuable advice to everyone who's listening.
Well, I appreciate it, and I thank you for the opportunity. I really believe in this space, clearly, and I want people to, especially those that believe in this space, to have a platform and a way of accessing the most correct or educational information so they can convince their investors and their team to make the right decision. And so it has been an absolute pleasure to be on this podcast, and I thank you for it.
Oh, you're welcome. Folks, we're going to be doing a lot more with Jonathan. We'll be covering topics around real estate and the blockchain. Also, he referenced before talking about stable coins. There's going to be many topics that we're going to be covering, because to get a really concrete and very well-framed legal opinion is very interesting. But I still want to remind everyone that this is not investment advice. We're just giving you good old-fashioned education, and you must do your own research and due diligence. I would like to thank you again, audience, for listening to this week's podcast. And next week, we're going to be talking to Zelectrics, which is an up-and-coming AI blockchain project, which is centered around on and off-grid charging for EVs or electric vehicles. Again, thank you so much for listening. And please tell your friends that they can download us from many different platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Podbeam, and Spotify. Thanks again. Please leave positive comments on Twitter and Facebook. If you have anything that you want us to cover, please email us at education@savvydigital.com. That's SAVII digital.com. And if you have any questions for Jonathan, you can also email them to there and we will forward them directly to him. Again, thank you for joining us. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the CryptoCast podcast. Stay tuned in for more episodes.